winter meeting of the Greensboro Historical Society on Sunday, March 4th, 2007 in Fellowship Hall. The subject is Shaping Lives, 100 Years of Grange in Greensboro, and the Last Century of 4-H.
And many, many years, actually it's 100 years of the 4-H. We are celebrating lots of things, and I'm Jenny Stoner, I'm president of the Greensboro Historical Society, and we're very, very glad to have you here. We call this program Shaping Lives, and when you think about it, and what you're going to see, some of you have already been looking at the displays and seen your own pictures and your own things you have been involved in, but and also the Everything 4-H that is currently a very active group, that the Grange and the 4-H have been very, very important elements in shaping the lives of the people of this community. This is the 100th anniversary of the Greensboro Grange, and we're going to hear about its rich heritage. The 4-H Club has a proud history in the life of rural Vermonters, and we have the special opportunity to learn about the new directions of today's very active Everything 4-H. On our panel, we're most fortunate to have Elaine Dunbar, who will speak about the Grange. She's been very active and been the master or the president of the Caspian Lake Grange and also of the area, the Pomona Grange. She will speak about the Grange first. Lewis Hill will speak about the boys 4-H. Dorothy Ling about the girls 4-H. And then Louise Calderwood will give an introduction, and members of the Everything 4-H will speak for themselves. At the concluding segment of each program, what will come, and each segment will have a presentation at a beginning, and then a chance for conversation and memories of people who participated, and everybody, and then we'll go on to the next, so that we have questions and answers about each segment as we go along. Now, can you all see if we're seated? Is that work all right? Before turning it over to Elaine, I've been asked to give some background about the Grange. Shortly after the Civil War, in 1866, Oliver Hudson Kelly, who was regarded as the founder of the Grange movement, made a survey of the farm conditions in the South for the recently formed Department of Agriculture. He observed that the farmers were unhappy with the railroads and the other services, which made them feel at the mercy of the powerful business interests. And they could charge whatever they wanted, and the farmers had no say in it. And he felt this was not an acceptable way to go. And so decided that farmers needed to organize. He conceived the idea that a fraternal organization could change this, and that it would be composed of farmers from all sections of the country and would help heal the scars that were left by the Civil War, as well as improve the economic and social conditions of the farm population. So when he returned to Washington, Kelly communicated his plans to six friends and enlisted their support. On December 4, 1867, the National Grange was formally organized with the official name of the Patrons of Husbandry. How's that? That's not one I imagine you use very often anymore. The organization was influenced by the Masons, and but modeled after the old English granges or farms. It was built upon democratic expression and organization, whereby each member has the opportunity to help formulate the community, state, and national policies, with a full membership offered to any man or woman 13 and a half years of age or older. In fact, the Grange was the first organization in America to admit women to full membership on an equal basis with men. The officers were given titles found in the structure of the English Grange. The officers were the master, overseer, steward, assistant steward, and lady assistant steward. So there was a little distinction. Chaplain, lecturer who arranged programs, and secretary and treasurer. The themes were used to develop the ritual for the ceremonies incorporated that incorporate the agricultural faith in God and community. Excuse me, in the country. Meetings were held in the Grange Hall, and before long it became referred to as the Grange. The Grange has 7 degrees, 4 of them in the community, a 5th known as Pomona, or the area, and then 6th is the state, and the 7th is the national. And Elaine has been president, or the master, for both the local and the area. The Grange has long been active in forming public policy, and this was a real revelation to me. They lobbied nationally for government control over the railroads, because previously each owner of the railroad could decide for himself what to charge and what the rates would be, so it was a regulated rates. For interstate commerce, they helped form the Extension Service, which educated farmers in better conservation and animal breeding, and seed and selection practices. They were leaders in starting rural free delivery so that farmers wouldn't have to go to town to get their mail, and the Farm Credit Organization that provided farmers with cheaper credit than the banks offered. Locally, farmers formed cooperatives to buy seeds and fertilizer wholesaler and to better market their milk and livestock. And now, with this introduction of the overview, Elaine will tell you about the Caspian Lake Grange, which is celebrating 100 years.
The Greensboro Historical Society theme this year is Shaping Lives, and Caspian Lake Grange fills out in many ways. It was organized 100 years ago when there was no electricity, telephone, radios, televisions, and automobiles or social life except the church for the farm families. By 1907, Greensboro was ready for the Grange. In fact, a Caspian Lake Grange was organized much earlier in 1876, but there is no record of how long it lasted. A Greensboro Valley Grange was active between 1910 and 1916. The present Caspian Lake Grange was organized June 25, 1907, the 382nd Grange in the state of Vermont. C.J. Bell of Walden, who became Vermont's governor in 1916, organized the new Grange in the former town hall in the V of the Row in front of the present town hall, with 44 members signing in. 2 weeks later, 43 more members joined, and by 1916 there was a peak membership of 131, a long way from 54 at the 75th anniversary and 25 now. Meetings were held each second and fourth Thursday, and for many years they were held in the town hall. About 1910, Myron Kinney offered a building lot to the Grange, providing they would never hold dances, a promise the Grange refused to make. A few years later, Mr. Kinney decided that the Grangers didn't dance much and made the law unconditional. The Grange purchased the town hall for $310 in 1913, the year the present town hall was opened as an elementary school and high school. The Grange moved the building across the street to the Kinney Law. And just recently we had some work done the last few years, and one of the people who worked on the hall came up to me and said to me, "Has that building ever been moved?" And I said, "Yeah." "Oh, good," he says, "because the stringers are going the wrong way." A kitchen was completed in the basement in 1916, and it was voted to install electricity in 1917. Much volunteer labor and donation of much lumber and other materials made it all possible. Gradually, furniture was obtained, and when the Greensboro Valley Grange surrendered their charter, their regalia and implements were given to Caspian Lake Grange. New sashes were purchased and dedicated by the state master in 1978. Yearly program alerts were made out from the first with programs scheduled for each meeting. There were readings, songs, and often papers of discussions that required homework. Many were on improvements of the Grange, of the farm, or town. Debates were held on such topics as, which is it better, for a man to get up early or for one who is wide awake? Or more seriously, all nations should adopt a policy of free trade, or a vocational education is more valuable than a cultural one. There were neighbors' nights and open meetings, legislative nights and mystery rites, meetings led by officers and committee chairs as agriculture or youth night. Roll calls were amusing or serious. As time went on, there were travel talks, movies, outside speakers on special topics, ones with 4-H members and later the Girl Scouts. Degrees were usually given at least once a year. For a time, Caspian Lake Grange had a ladies' degree team with marches and drills that went to other granges, led by Mrs. Nellie Getty. Program booklets usually listed officers and members. In 1907, there were 75 members. In 1917, 131, and in 1936, 90. In 1990, 44, and now 25. As with most groups, the Grange had to make money. The dues each member paid didn't meet subordinate dues to the state and expenses of the group and the building. From the first, meals were served usually at 10 cents a plate, but going up as prices increased. Strawberry suppers were held in the summer and others were served. For several years, United Farmers annual suppers were catered meals, were put on for Greensboro High alumni banquet and the town meeting dinners. Sometimes there were fairs and food sales. In early years, the Nellie Guild players put on plays and the Grange received a percentage. Whist card parties have been popular at different times. Dances were sponsored several summers and at times profits were shared with Greensboro Nursing Home. Now the hall is used by other groups with only donations and the cleanup fee required. The Grange is a legislative group and each Grange is invited to present resolutions to the state Grange. If approved at the annual state session, they go to the state legislature. These have included urging against Olio in 1912 and against coloring in 1951, favoring the repeal of daylight time in 1919, and asking for either daylight or standard to be used throughout the state in 1947. One resolution went to the federal government urging action to continue support of local health centers. Grange influence has improved regulations of railroad rates and made their schedules better, brought in free, rural-free delivery, the extension service, and farm credit. Grange is also noted for serving the community, and in April, which is Grange Month, non-members are awarded community service awards. Some of these have included, but not limited to, because I'm sure I've missed somebody somewhere. Would you raise your hand if you are here today, please? Lewis and Nancy Hill, Donald and Madeline Gebby, Donald and Laura Drown, Everett Young, Henry Merrill, the Greensboro Fire Department. More recent awards went to Cheryl Lumsden, Ellen Kerr, Lorraine and Harold Tallman, Bill Eisner, the Rescue Squad, Leona Collier, Shirley King, Bert Stone, Wilhelmina Smith, I know she's here, Helen Ambrosini, the Greensboro Health Center, and Kim and Peg Elgilmar. And the last one that we gave last year went to Teresa Snow of the Salvation Farms. Pomona Grange gives awards to both non-members and to members, and in 1989, one was given to Hazel Guile. And there have been several others, hopefully, who have received them. I think Dorothy has. Pomona one? I think so. Caspian Lake Grange has had a policy of sharing with others from the first Kern Hatton Holmes mentioned in 1908 was one of the first. Others have been helped, including a family in trouble, Children's Aid, and Red Cross drives. In 1940, the community service contest began, and bigger projects developed. In 1968 to 1987, Casting Lake Grange placed in 7 yearly state contests with 4 firsts, 2 seconds, and 1 third. Top winners received money. These projects included helping begin the Caspian Lake Area Special Education School, improvements to the public beach, graveling the shore, building bathhouses, and providing rafts and tables, as well as sponsoring swimming classes for a time. The school vault launch was sponsored and supported for 12 years. Roadsides were made and put up during the National Bicentennial in 1976, and the last ones replaced later. Some of them were replaced several times. They got to be good collector's items, I guess. Rooms in the former nursing home were papered and painted. Also, sewing was done for the nursing home. And at one time, people went down every Saturday and served a snack in the morning to people there. When there was a threat to tear down the town hall building and build a town office in its place, Grange members were active in preventing this and in restoring the building. Grange has also worked on several Greensboro cemeteries, including the White, the Baker, the Mitchell, and the Village cemeteries. And if somebody knows afterwards, after the meeting, would they tell me where the Baker one is? Because I missed that one. We also had a Waterbury project, and in that case, what we did was they named a person at the state hospital, and it was our job to see that that person was recognized with a card or a letter every month of the year, as well as special times such as birthdays and Christmas and so forth. The Grange was the first fraternal group to offer equal membership to women. The first master and lecturer were Mr. and Mrs. B.H. Fairbanks. In 1920, Mrs. Millie Gebbie was the first woman to serve as master, and during her 3 years of service, all officers were women except one. During 100 years, the Grange has developed contests to challenge members to win prizes. The lecturer offers several contests, photography, talent, skit writing, and performance of skits, writing poetry, and book descriptions. The Women's Activities or Home Economics Chair has contests in sewing, embroidery, knitting, crocheting, and baking, and the youth chair offers a variety of activities. There is a junior Grange in some towns with training and leading meetings and providing many activities. Several subordinate Granges unite into the Pomona Grange, with Caspian Lake Grange belonging to Hazen Road Pomona number 15, with Caledonia Grange number 9 of East Hardwick. They were the 9th Grange in the state of Vermont, and Lamoille Grange in Morrisville, up until 2006. Now the Pomona has been reorganized with fewer Pomonas and covering a larger area. Caspian Lake Grange belongs to Kingdom Pomona number 35, which covers much of the Northeast Kingdom. I should say right here that I need to make a correction in what Mrs. Stoner said. I never was officially the master of Caspian Lake Grange. No. I did run it, but I wasn't the official master. But as you all know, in small towns, sometimes somebody gets sick and somebody else has to do the job. And there were times like that. I did, however, serve as master of Pomona. Grangers have been awarded for long terms of membership. At the 25th anniversary, Silver Star certificates were given to 16 members, and at the 50th, Golden Sheaf certificates went to Mr. and Mrs. P.N. Allen, Mr. and Mrs. John Barrington, Mr. and Mrs. Elsa Gebbie, Mr. and Mrs. Charles Lapierre, and Mrs. V.M. Woolley. At the 70th anniversary, Mrs. Flora Lapierre was honored as the only living charter member. A 50-year pin and certificate went to Will Massey, and a 25 one to Philip Gray. In 1990, Marjorie LaPierre and Raymond Mercier became 50-year members, and Arlt LaPierre and Robert Wilson, 60-year members. Dorothy Lane became a 50-year member in 1996. At the 100th anniversary of Caspian Light Grange, no more than two or three members are eligible for the 50-year certificate. And I believe one of those is Mary Merrill, who's with us today. Caspian Light Grange has had many good years since 1907. It brightened the lives of lonely farm families, helped them learn public speaking, and helped them to lead meetings as well as to gain knowledge of many things. The biggest advantage these families had was to find a social life that had been limited by lack of electricity, telephones, radios, televisions, and automobiles. Now that these are all available, and it works in reverse. It is harder to find new members with all the other things available. Also, since the 75th anniversary, Caspian Light Grange has lost many 50-year members one by one. Marjorie and Arlt LaPierre, Erwin and Beatrice White, Robert and Harriet Wilson, and Raymond Mercier, and also the younger Erwin White Jr. Caspian Light Grange has some faithful new members now, and also people interested in joining. In the past, only loyal members willing to take responsibility made that 100 years possible, and our Grange still has hope for the future. This summer, as we celebrate our 100th year, we hope to have you all visit our display of historical things from the last 100 years, including such things as old needlework patterns, old tools, an old Grange memorabilia, which is on here. This year, we have a special project which it covers the entire state of Vermont, and this is for the community service one. And I have this with me today, and I'll put it over there. And what it is it's a telephone number that people can take, and if you know of someone who is in danger of being hungry, I don't mean just I'd like a snack because it's not quite supper time. I mean hungry. This is a helpline that you can access, and they will get help for food stamps for people. And I'm sure you can call that number, whether it's for an older person or a younger person. It doesn't make any difference. But hunger in Vermont is a problem which we've been working on. And I forgot something. I told Peg that before I gave my speech that we would have the flag salute and the Star Spangled Banner. And of course I forgot. My apologies, Peg.
So
if you will all stand and join me in the flag salute.
Well, this is where you start the meetings.
Normally we start the meetings this way, yes. With the flag salute, we have the Bible upon the table. And I think knowing how flags are, I have that setting all right once. I probably shouldn't have done that, but no, okay. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Now this is a real test for us.
Thank you.
We hope you will all look at our display on the table. It covers 100 years, and we'll have even more things in the summer, so we hope you will join us then. It is tentatively scheduled for whichever weekend Greensboro has their 4th of July celebration. I don't know that yet, so I can't tell you which days it will be. But I hope that you will also be interested in joining the Grange, and that any time that you are interested, give me a call. I would be glad to talk with you. I'd be glad to give you an application. And we are always looking for new members. And anybody that's over 14, and if you aren't quite 14, I know who to go and get special permission so you can join. There are times in life, it's who you know. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Elaine. Now is the time for little sharing, and I'd like to open that with some sharing, some memories of Madeline Gebbe, whom I had the pleasure of sitting next to at a luncheon at Christmas time. And she said that when she and her husband were a young married couple, the Grange was their social life. There were meetings, I believe it was every other week, and they had dinners, and they were on the dinner committee, and they and two other couples were the ones who helped set it up and did dishes, and they had music and programs, and the Grange really was very, very important to their lives. And that's where their best friends were, and they always got together. But I hope there's somebody else here who's got some. Janet?
I remember going to a box supper party where the women made the box lunch and decorated it, and somebody bought it, and then we played whist afterwards. I think I probably was 12 at the time. And Barney Allen, who was to me about 104, bought my box. But it was a fun evening.
Are there any other reminiscences of
yes? I'm Margaret Bella, but my parents were I'm still a member, and I come to these meetings occasionally. I know my parents were busy every other week because every Thursday night they went to Grange. All the refreshments were always the kinds that farmers have. You know, you didn't get a cookie and a glass of coffee. It was a sandwich or sandwiches and cake or, you know, just sort of almost a meal. We got to eat the leftovers. It also helped at the dances. They sponsored square dances at the town hall, and we sold soda and that kind of thing at the square dances, so I remember doing that. And I know my parents worked in the cemetery, and many of the projects she talked about that I got to help with just because I was part of the family. So it's a good thing to do.
Are there any other memories or stories of the Grange?
I don't want to steal some. then a friend, way to start out, because you learn a lot of things that don't come natural to you, like speaking and all that sort of thing. So I'm awfully glad I've had Grange in the next grade.
Well, when I read about the all the legislative stuff, it made me think of the League of Women Voters. That just as the same kind of learning about the issues and getting very well informed and then making a difference.
By which I teach at the North Country Career Center, and I teach ACT programs, so 1970, the Smith-Hughes Act, directly comes from your hard work. Thank you.
The way has been impacted in ways we're not aware of. And so now let's turn to the 4-H clubs. The Grange was organized for the adults, and the 4-H was organized for the youth initially. Evolved from numerous rural clubs formed in the late 1800s to give farm youth some social and learning skills, and that the Boys and Girls and Scouts and similar groups enjoyed in other places. It was formally organized and adopted the familiar four-leaf clover emblem in 1907. So that this really is a centennial year. In the historical study, we've done a lot of centennials and bicentennials, and we didn't realize it was a centennial across the thing. And the four H's stand for? There it is. Head, heart, hands, and health. I've got a little background on the Orleans County 4-H before Lewis and Dorothy give us on the local area. In 1919, 4-H work was started in Orleans County by Miss Marjorie Goose, who was a member of the Extension Service. So again, it started by someone in the government. And for the next 2 years, Mr. Milo Bacon was hired to start 4-H clubs in the area. At the end of the first year, he had started not one or two, but 27 clubs and a total of 393 members. 4-H was already important in building future citizens and young people and were enthusiastic about joining. And to be able to continue the work, a campaign was organized for fundraising so that in 1925, a permanent full-time person, Miss Flora Coutts, was hired as the first Orleans County 4-H agent. And towns voted to support the 4-H club work and at town meetings, and it expanded rapidly. There was a junior council of outstanding 4-H members who were at least 15 and had 5 years of 4-H club experience. The council worked with the county agent for develop activities, and one activity decided it needed was a camp. So for 6 years, there was a week-long camp at different locations. 1 year it was at Caspian Lake, 1 year it was at Glimpha Magog, another year it was at Brownington. By 1930, the work of the camp was considered so important, they said, we need a permanent camp. And Brownington said, we'll offer to have a regular site here. But when Derby heard about it, they said, we want it. And the town officers offered a lease on land at Salem Pond with 100 feet of shorefront, and they offered to build a road to the site so that they could put up buildings. And this was voted at the town meeting. And after the town meeting, the 4-H'ers began making plans. The junior council pledged to raise, now this was 1930. And you know what happened in 1929? There was a stock crash. So 1930 was the beginning of the Depression. And yet they pledged to raise $1,000, which was a lot of money, and which they thought would be enough. And club members and leaders and interested citizens spent hours cleaning the land and getting ready and raising money with sales and suppers and other fundraising activities. And they raised $1,000, and guess what? Discovered that wasn't quite enough. They needed $2,000, and so they raised the $2,000. And in the end, it was all raised. The building was constructed with a combination of paid carpenters and lots of volunteering of labor and materials. The camp was opened July 27th, 1932, ready for many, many years of use. So with a full-time enthusiastic county agent, Flora Coutts, and connections to both the state and national 4-H clubs, the county 4-H clubs was established and flourishing. And Greensboro 4-H started in the 1920s, and many local youths involved. Some older people may remember Flora Coutts, the first agent, and her tremendous energy in organizing. And now I'm going to turn it over to Lewis Hill, and he's going to tell us about the Boys 4-H and all his involvement with it.
I never was in 4-H, but my older brother and sister were in the 20s with Flora Coutts, and she really was a remarkable person. But my first memory, because they met at the houses, they used to meet at ours sometime, I was about 6 or 7. One time she brought down a movie, and she ran it off her car battery. Nobody had electricity, and they had to crank it by hand. It was pretty jerky, but nobody had ever seen a movie before, so it was really pretty impressive. So this is one thing that 4-H did. It was sponsored by the Extension Service, who had not had really very good luck convincing farmers to change their agricultural methods. The guys hadn't really changed farming much for 50 years, and they really didn't intend to. So the Extension Service thought maybe if they worked with the kids, they could accomplish something. And so they did this. So they took them around, showed them good farms where they were doing things, and hopefully that they would come back and get their parents interested in it. I got the 4-H Club because James Daly, who was a minister here, some of you may remember him, about 5 boys went to him one time and asked him to help him start a club. So he did, but he didn't know anything about 4-H either, but it got off to a kind of shaky start. But Mrs. Alice Leonard was a agent then, and but unfortunately James had to leave within a little while, so he asked me if I would take it. And of course I really didn't want to, I didn't know anything about it, but I agreed to, and then I had to face these 5 guys one meeting with none of us really knowing what we were doing, what it was all about. But Mrs. Leonard was wonderful. She began by bringing me down a stack of 4-H literature that was about this high, and it had projects that I'd never heard of in it even anyway. But they had been clubs starting in Greensboro over the years, and sometimes the leaders would ask me to help them, and I'd go to a meeting to them. I really wasn't interested. It just seems like the way they were done was the leader would have the meetings in the schoolhouse after school, and they would just lecture the kids. The kids had to sit in a row and listen to something that's pretty boring for a long time. And so we decided that wasn't going to work. None of the clubs seemed to last very long. So we decided to gotta have fun. And so we decided that we would have a fun 4-H, and if they learned something, that would be even better. And so we went camping, and we went climbing mountains, and had games and contests and everything, and it worked out pretty good. We started with a dairy club, but a lot of the guys weren't too crazy about dairying, so we shifted to, we also added gardening, poultry, and forestry, and some things like that. Forestry was a good chance, good excuse to go camping, and our club was growing pretty fast, and it got really a little too big for me. We had about 20 in it. And so Irwin White offered to take the dairy club, which was really great. And Henry Merrill decided to take a club of handicraft, woodworking, and so on like that. And I hope he'll tell a bit about that in a few minutes. And so that worked out good. But the club did continue to grow some, and we would have sometimes maybe 20 or so members in it. One time it got up to 30, which was far too much again. But we tried to get them a lot of different experiences, and one of them was to go to 4-H camp, because a lot of them had never left home before, even for a few minutes, overnight or anything. So we had one boy who was 14, and I suggested he go, and he wasn't interested, but his parents were. So they were really pushing him to go. And I agreed to take him up to camp and leave him on Sunday night. And he complained all the way up. And I said that if he didn't like it, to drop me a card and I'd go pick him up. So I think he wrote the cards after he got there. I got it the next day. He said, "You told me you'd come and get me if I didn't like it. And I don't like it. I hate it." So I thought I wouldn't come up the next day, so I waited till Wednesday and I went up. And that day, the school nurse had agreed to kiss all the boys goodnight, and there was no way he'd get that boy home. So that's just some of the delightful things that happened. We have an exhibit over here that shows some of the things we did. We have a scrapbook with a lot of pictures, and the people in there you can recognize. And it lasted for 30 years, luckily. And then the kid population in Greensboro just seemed to peter out, so we had to drop it. But it was, I think, a great experience for us all. I'd like to have some of the boys in my club maybe talk a little bit about some of the things they did. They're willing. Quite a few of them are here now.
Why don't they stand up?
Yeah, all stand up.
Fern Fontaine, one of the great experiences was being from a rural area. We went to New York City, and that was quite an experience. And you know, you get to see a different culture, a different way of life, and that was an eye-opener for me. And just knowing the mentorship that we had was a very positive, and 4-H was, for all of us, a very positive experience. And thank you for Lewis and for the Extension Service for having such a great program.
Thanks, Ben. One of the things I remember about that New York trip was we took the boys over to the Palisades Park and rode on the biggest roller coaster of the year at that time. And I had two rides right together, my first and my last.
The other thing I remember is going down a one-way street the wrong way.
Yep. Created a lot of yelling and there's this policeman came over and stopped me and said, Vermont, huh? He says, I know you don't have any one-way streets in Vermont, but let me tell you about New York. So he turned me around, stopped all the traffic.
I'm Ray Fontaine, Fern's youngest brother and Vern's youngest brother. I enjoyed being in 4-H, doing all sorts of trips. Fighting forest fires, I can remember fighting forest fires, helping the fire department out. We had some dry years, and we'd go help them, and we did fundraising events, pulling seedlings, and always a treat afterwards. We'd go get ice cream after we made money for the club, and we just did a lot of exciting things. Forestry tour, I can remember going on a forestry tour and learning about different species of trees and seeing different parts of Vermont. All the trips, you know, Eastern States, Montreal, just had a good time, and we're blessed. We live even closer than most kids to Lewis, so we got to do a lot of things with him, and enjoyed having him as a neighbor, and he's got a wonderful wife that supported us, and we're thankful to both of them.
Thank you. Thanks, Raymond.
Ed Grosshue, you mentioned in your comments that the 4-H population was starting to peter out. And I think that that's probably when you decided to jump the county line into Caledonia, which is where I lived, in the Bend, closer to East Hardwick. I first met Lewis when I was 14 years old back in 64, working for Phil and Pauline Demers on the farm. And I come from a family of six kids. I was the only boy, so I led sort of a solitary life as the only son. And my only friends, really, that I associated with was the Fredettes and the Mitchers, who had a farm next door to me. And they meant a lot to me at that time. And once I met Lewis, and he brought me into the 4-H fold, is when I started to bloom and develop and come out of my shell, so to speak. And he was very instrumental in helping me develop into the person that I've become today. And there were a lot of advantages of being a 4-H'er. Of course, everything that we've heard so far is certainly all part of that. But public speaking skills, being able to get out there and mingle and be successful with people skills was very important, and Lewis was very instrumental for that for me. And of course, you branch out and meet new people, other 4-H'ers, And that's where, as a result of that, through the junior leadership activities, we met other 4-H'ers from throughout Orleans County. And that's where I met my wife, Sally, wherever she's at, back to my grandson. She was a 4-H'er up in the, with a club up in the Charleston area. And I, you know, I always, you know, pick on her about the fact that one of the reasons I joined 4-H was because I was looking for a wife. I knew that if I got a 4-H wife, she could cook, sew, and be a good mother for my children, and that she certainly has not let me down at all. And we've been married now for, it's going to be 37 years in December. And as much as I can say what I'm saying right now, I don't think that there are any words that can fully express my personal appreciation for what you've done for me.
Really, I didn't tell any of them to say that.
I'll turn it around on you, Lewis. I'm Richard Champagne. I was in the 4-H Club also. I always knew that Lewis had a good sense of humor. He would have jokes from the old times, say, like, I'm a self-made man, of course, which shows the horror of unskilled labor.
One of the things we did was have 2-minute talks at the end of 4-H meetings, and the kids kind of started out hesitantly, but they gave some wonderful talks. And I remember one boy was all excited one time as he told us about being stuck on the Ferris wheel for a long time when it broke down. But there were a lot of very interesting talks. Tom Hurst said he really learned to speak well there. Later he became a minister that he was in 4-H, so the county 4-H program did a lot.
I'm Mario Fredette. I never learned how to speak very well, one little story I want to tell you is I had a chance to go to Chicago on a 4-H trip. I did go to Washington, D.C., but I had a chance to go to Chicago, and that weekend we had to go to an interview at the county with the Extension Service, I believe, to accept us as a candidate. Anyway, I had a cousin that came. Thank you.
That's right.
Well, I'm Dennis. I don't know if I took your place at the interview, Mario, but I did end up going to Chicago.
I wanted to tell you a little story about that. When we were on the way back, this was in 1970. You know, take a bus to Montreal and an Air France jet 747 right after seeing, remember that movie there, that Air France jet that crashed? And anyway, there we were getting on the plane. Bruce Urie and I were there. Anyway, had a great time over there. On the way home, weather was bad, it's a week later. Couldn't land into Burlington with the airplane. Ended up in Boston, taking a bus to Burlington, which was fine. Hey, we were having a good time. Get to Burlington in the middle of the night, dark, unloading suitcase. And I don't remember, I think my mother picked me out. Finally get home, she got to looking at the suitcase. She says, you know, you must have been sleeping because this is not your suitcase. And it happened to be a girl that was on a trip. I opened it up and was like, oh my, is this your suitcase? Finally, just a lot of good times. And I think one of the important things about all this too is, like Lewis said earlier in his presentation, you know, he never really lectured us. He let us have fun, kind of gave us a little rope, you know, a little slack to go do stuff. Today you could never do that. It would have been all kidnapped, you know, the way the world's changed in the last 30, 40 years. But going to Eastern States, you know, he'd say, go ahead and set your stuff up and do what you want. He'd be off visiting, you know, which was great because we learned to take care of it. And I think that was part of having fun making your own decisions, too. And, never a dull moment, I can tell you that.
We really were very lucky to have a very responsible club. And like you said, that they would come up home usually the night, a few nights before, and plan the exhibit. And, you know, the first half hour, it was just silly, and a lot of things, they come up with crazy ideas and everything. But finally, somebody would have a brilliant idea, and they'd all get together and plan it. And when they take all this stuff into, find out where it was, is it at Eastern States, and set it up. Like he said, I went off and looked at the other ones, and somebody would come along, ask them where their leader was, and they didn't know. But I didn't worry about them. They put together a good exhibit.
My name is Gerard Fontaine. I know Lewis from ever since I was a little kid like that. I remember going over to his place. And I've learned a lot since then. There's so many things that I've learned that I can't explain them all. But I've learned to go help him and lead people to certain plants, stuff like that, to get them at his nursery. And with 4-H, I've helped fight forest fires. And I've also gone to the 4-H camp in Derby. And one of the greatest things that I learned there was we had rifle shooting, we used to go out camping, we had archery. And one of the fun things we used to do is to help clean up the place. We used to have clam contests. We'd be broken up different groups, and because the clams would hurt people's feet. It would cut people's feet, so we'd have clam contests, and whoever got the most clams would win. But anyways, last year, I went to the anniversary the year before, and they don't do that anymore, so hopefully, I talked to them about that, the contest we had, and hopefully they'll start it up again, because it was a lot of fun for us. It was a great experience. And I enjoyed a lot of people in my life through 4-H. I went to the two big trips, some of the trips in Washington, D.C., and it's just so many things that I've learned that it's a never-ending experience. Thank you, Lewis.
Thank you, Gerard. He didn't tell you about the time he and Richard went to Expo in Montreal, went off and got lost, and we waited for him for hours and hours. He didn't go home without him, but it was getting very tough.
Henry.
I'd like to say one more thing. Collectively, I think responsibilities that we learned through 4-H is what's really gotten all of us to where we are. I have the opportunity to go to Washington, D.C., and I did meet the president, shake hands with the president and the vice president. And also, at Eastern States Exposition, I did a demonstration, and Lewis is right. There are many different demonstrations going on at the same time, and this particular demonstration was on chainsaw safety. So you want the crowd to be watching you, so we talk about what you're going to do. He says, you figure out how you're going to do this. So obviously you start up a chainsaw, make a lot of racket, and a lot of people come see your demonstration. So I think this is what we learned from Lewis. You need to be proactive, and you need to learn, figure out ways where you can have the most effect on everybody else that's watching. And certainly that's had been an impact on my life. I am now a career center teacher, and Lewis, one of the greatest things you could have done for me was given me the chance to be who I am, give me the self-confidence, and I think this is what this is all about. This is what how we improve lives, and I think it's paying forward. And I think you're paying forward for somebody must have helped you, but you certainly have helped all of us become who we are and helping others do that. So, collectively, thank you very much.
I'll just speak without the microphone. Collectively, as Bernard was mentioning, I'd like to present this plaque with this poem to Lewis. I'm presenting it to Lewis on behalf of our 4-H club and all of the members who are present, and who are certainly not present here today. When he hangs this up in his home, everybody that reads this poem will know that it's for him, even though his name is not on it. But also, as I recite this poem, I want everybody here who has worked with children to know that this extends to you as well. It reads, 100 years from now, it will not matter what my bank account was, the sort of house I lived in or the kind of car I drove, but the world may be different. Untouching. Because I was important in the life of a child, and this is a poem by Forrest Whitcraft, and I think that this would be very very becoming for the world.
Would you like to tell about your club, sir, please?
I really don't have very much to say.
Was one that when the trip to Chicago, and when he was in my car, Doug.
Yeah, Doug.
Yeah.
Both Doug and Bob were in your club, I guess, and both of them had animals.
Yeah. I know when Fernand went to Chicago. I think it was Raymond. Was it Raymond?
Raymond Chicago.
Raymond went to Chicago. And he got his picture in the paper with Miss America. I don't think he remembers anything else.
Unlike the nurse at the 4-H camp, I couldn't kiss her.
Lois had a wonderful operation there. It kept sort of pretty big. I don't know how many people you had at one time. I guess, 17 or 18 people.
And sure. Ended up over the 30 years, we had 181.
Yeah.
Can I say just one other thing? I remember when I went to Washington, D.C., we were fortunate to go to the Capitol, and I met Winston Prouty. I don't know if somebody here, I'm sure, voted for him, but I got to shake hands. I got to shake hands with him. My hand went right to his elbow. The man didn't have a thumb.
Oh,
and,
really?
You know, and I'll never forget that. And I got to meet George Aiken. Well, he was there. So anyway, these trips really meant big. You know, we got to meet some really, important people. And we couldn't have done it without 4-H. So, very nice.
And
is it true, Lewis, that your
experience camping with 4-H club members around Long Pond gave the impetus to the creation of the Long Pond Preserve. Well, I wouldn't claim that. I don't know. I remember Mr. Freeman liked to have us camp up there because that land was in dispute. And he thought if it was being used by somebody with his permission, it helped him.
Well, that was just very, very interesting to hear about the impact of the boys' 4-H, and now Dorothy will tell us about the girls' 4-H.
Our 4-H clubs always started our 4-H meetings by having the 4-H pledge and the Vermont anthem, so I think we should start that way. So if you'd all stand up, Louis, could you hold this up and if anybody needs help?
Do you remember that?
And the 4-H's
told
the
motion.
I pledge
my hand to serve the king, my heart to greater loyalty, my hands to larger service, and my health to better living, for my club, my community, and my country.
And my world.
And my world. And all of that. Meg Eigelhart will start us off with the Vermont anthem. We have copies of it. Solved the problem because it was messed up in my area at that time, at least not for the girls. So she told me how I could be a loan member and could do the work. She brought me the directions for it and the record blanks to fill out and all that. And I had first year of sewing. So with my grandmother's help, I was able to do years of 4-H work. And then when I heard about 4-H camp starting, and they had had one in Greensboro, so I thought that sounded like a good trip. But again, I wasn't so lucky. I did so much that I got in trouble with my parents because and they just said no, I couldn't do it. And I never quite figured out whether it was because whether we were short of money or whether it was because they were afraid I would get homesick. Doing it, my history, a lot of what I have is, I'll roll off my mind like his, but I got it from clippings and records and things like that. And in a 1930s record book, it told about a rock and rock club being led by Thomas Forth and a Maple Grove Busy Bee Club being led by Mrs. Archie Lamundy, with members Julie Kubas, Evelyn, and Elmer Chatney. And those clubs were soon moved over, shifted over to people living in the edge of East Grassbury. When my sister Clara White was old enough to go, she was luckier. She became a member of the Maple Grove Busy Bees, led by Mabel Graham at that time, and co-led by Lois Gebby fairly soon. And in another scrapbook, I found proof that there were girls in the club that listed Alice Logan, Margaret Morris, and Alice Rogers, and a little later clip in Clara White, as winning prizes in their sewing contest. And in the 1937 program for the Orleans County 4-H Roundup, which happened every year, the Maple Grove Busy Bees, led by Lois Gebby, and the Rocking Rock Club, led by John Gebby, gave a skit, and they both earned 100% awards because they had all the records that come in. Clara White wrote a note about her experiences, and it gives you an idea what the early clubs might have been like. I was in 4-H for 10 years, from 8 to 18 years of age. We started with Mabel Graham as a leader that first year and met in her house. That year we made aprons and laundry bags and so forth. The second year, third year, we did cooking, and we learned basic facts about nutrition and rules for making such things as muffins, cakes, and pie crust. We took hikes and field trips. I remember going to visit the hospital in Waterbury and also the state prison. We went to 4-H camp for a week at Flora Coots camp. The girls' dorms on one end and the boys on the other. We learned swimming and crafts besides teaching classes and attending classes and demonstrations. And in the evenings we had bonfires and toasted marshmallows and sat around singing. I remember going to State Week at UVM. We had classes and demonstrations again, recreation. One evening we had a moonlight ride on the Ticonderoga. In 1918, Margaret Morris and I were that leader. Lois Gebby went to Eastern States Expedition in Springfield, Massachusetts. And we had made our uniforms or dresses by that time. So we wore those whenever we worked in the 4-H groups where we answered questions and told about 4-H. And we spent the time with delegates from other Vermont clubs. My last year, I remember being picked up at UVM where I was a freshman. And we all went to a sleepout on Butland Mountain, which is in the southern part of Vermont. In fact, it was near the Morse family that had moved from Greensboro, and the Morse girls had joined in the outing, so we all went up on the mountain and slept on the ground. Some of the times I learned in 4-H was about the same thing you got for 2 years of high school. We exhibited our sewing and cooking products at local fairs in Barton and Lindenville. Then going on to the other clubs, the girls' club went into the 40s. But I'm not sure whether that and the Red Clover 4-H Club overlap. Mary Merrill led the 4-H Clover Club for many years, but she says that I started the club and we had met together after she started working with her daughter at the club. 1948, the county found up. There's four clubs in Peter Trail: Red Clover 4-H Club, Caspian Lake Club, and the Bend Pigtails 4-H Club, and the Teen Age Arts and Crafts. Roundup in 49, this was in the Greensboro Grange Hall. The Mohawk Valley Lasses Club, led by Dorothy Davis, with Helen DeMars helping her as a leader, junior leader, is named. But the Pigtails 4-H Club is mentioned. And from what I've heard about some of the Bend girls having pigtails, they probably was two clubs were put together. In 1948 and 49, ground up programs of several pages of awards given for the clubs receiving 100% club if records were in, or an honor club, and for their clubs with the best health and recreation programs. The girls and the boys, of course, were recognized for the best officers report, secretary, treasurer, and news reporter, and for project work, homemakers, demonstrations, judging, food, and sewing, including their best review. In these two yearly program books, 60 girls' names are listed, both from the village and the Bend area, as well as the clubs. And song sheet pages were always in the roundup programs because singing was a part of every 4-H activity. I found in the old papers Gloria Stone's 4-H secretary's book, secretary's report book, in 1952, and I put it out over there with it open to the names of people that were in the club. There were 20 in the club that year. And she also gave reports of their meetings, including the business part of it and the work that they were doing, sewing or cooking and the recreation, because there always was meant to be recreation at a meeting. In the 53 Roundup program, there's 44 clubs in Orleans County and three in Greensboro, two boys clubs in the 4-H Red Clover. And that was what happened. It was the same idea in the 54, 53, 54, and 55. But they did list the community committees. And on those were Mr. and Mrs. Robert Willey and Laura Brown in the village, and Dorothy Davis in the Bend. Junior leaders played a big part in the club when they had 5 years of club work and were 15. In the roundups of the 50s, the following girls were listed as junior leaders. Denny Sauls, now hoping you can put the married names on them, I didn't count them all up, so I know most of them. Denny Sauls, Elna Hill, Frances Allen, Shirley Chaping, Dennis Allen, and Gloria Stone. They taught first year programs, help the leaders in many ways. Sometimes, as in the case of my daughter, Alice began the meeting while I was late because she came home from work. One junior leader, Dennis Allen Carr, writes the benefit that 4-H had for her. I joined 4-H Club at age 8 and enjoyed it. I felt my senior year in high school. I left my senior year in high school because I didn't have the time. I was a junior leader at least the last 2 years and assisted in teaching the first year cooks. One fond memory I have is going to the county meetings, is when the roll call was called, each club had to get up in front and do something short. I remember Denny Sauls, who was a junior leader, teaching us to sing to the tune of the Stars and Stripes Forever, this little ditty. Be kind to your web-footed friend, for the duck may be somebody's mother. Be kind to your friend in the swamp. I recall it's cool as that. You may think this is the end. Well, it is. And they got a big, big laugh. I remember that in my first demonstration at the county food meeting, I was scared, so I didn't say at the end, are there any questions? Because I didn't want them to ask any. I was marked down for that, but it was easier next time. This was important because later when I had to get up in front and teach my peers, when I learned and 4-H helped me, it also helped in teaching in public. I wasn't very good in sewing, but when I began to sew for my kids and myself, the basics came back, and with the help of my grandmother, I became efficient. My sister Frances remembers our sewing and crafts that we did. When we
lived in Dorset, my neighbor got me to be the first year cook. Later, when my daughter became 8, she wanted to be in 4-H, but there was no club. So I volunteered to teach cooking for her and her friends. While food cooked, we would talk about balancing our diet. I continued to be a leader until the children outgrew 4-H. I haven't found any roundup copies since 1955, but there was a scrapbook clipping of a 1963 photo of a dress review showing Margaret Wilson at Mary Merrill's club. In the 1960s, Ida Allen and the Bend joined Dorothy Bing and the Red Clover 4-H Club. Several Bend girls joined, including the Allen daughter and the Atha Hill girls, the Gaborio girls, and maybe some others. And also there were girls from the village area in the club. The long-term leaders include Mabel Graham, Lois Gebby, Dorothy Day, Mary Merrill, Carol Smith, Dorothy Davis, and Helen Durant worked with her as a junior leader, and Ida Allen. And I may have skipped some, so if anybody knows of any others, sometime I hope you'll tell me about them, because we have an exhibit next summer and we want to get everybody in it. County agents during those years were Flora J. Coots, Alice M. Leonard, and Marion Moriarty. In the late 1950s, the Flora Coots 4-H Club was becoming inadequate for the many people that wanted to be in the program. Where plans were initiated by Marion Moriarty, and they began in 1958, with land being given, and for 2 years, the tents were used on the land about a quarter mile from the main building. The Marion Moriarty Annex was dedicated in 1962 in her memory. And today, the camp is known as the Coots Moriarty 4-H Camp. 4-H clubs have had many rewards for members as they exhibited their work at Barton and I and Lindenville Fair, or at least at local open meetings and town fairs. They attended state meetings and worked as a week-long one, and many got to go to Eastern States Exposition in Springfield. In the uniforms that they had made, they could attend the booths. The outstanding ones were chosen to attend national meetings in Chicago and Washington, D.C. And I don't think our clubs have the records that Lewis has done. I talked with my daughter, who did go to Chicago last night, and she doesn't remember any of the girls being chosen to go to either Chicago or Washington. But maybe we can skip some of them that we should hear about. The Girls 4-H Club ended in Greensboro in the early 1970s. They had been active about 40 years, training many girls for the future. People hate to see the club work in Greensboro stop, but the leaders were becoming burned out, and the young people becoming more and more busy in school and activities. We don't quite agree on that, do we? Jenny Sauls wrote to me, and Jenny Sauls Allen wrote to me and included a message. It should be addressed to any or other 4-H leader. I am sending some of my memories that I have kept to remind me of what a wonderful experience 4-H was. As I look back, I marvel at your patience in dealing with all of us. We were lucky to have you. Of the many things you taught, learning to be a part of a team and then moving on to a leadership role was the most important. It helped me in every part of my life. I think we may have one or two, a few people that wanted to be talked about, not many of the boys.
Maybe I'll just sit on Felix's lap.
No.
Well, I don't know. I think there was some discrimination going on because I don't remember any trips to Washington, D.C. or Chicago. We only went to Barton, and that was scary enough. To this day, when I head that direction, my blood pressure goes up and I start to get nervous thinking about all those cooking demonstrations and the dreaded dress review. Now, for those of you that don't know me, I grew up here, but I wasn't born here. I got here as soon as I could. We moved here when I was 8, and I was a member of the 4-H for a long, long time. Then I got married, went out to the big bad world, and then we came back as soon as we could. So here we are. But 4-H had a huge impact on me. My grandmother was always good with her hands, but grandmothers have trouble teaching their granddaughters things because the granddaughters are a little stubborn sometimes. So I learned the most important thing in 4-H, and Mary Merrill taught me, and it was sewing. But I learned so much more than sewing. I am a professional quilt maker, and for the last 25 years I have traveled around the world teaching color and design to quilt makers. I also...
Those who have, don't know, there's one of our examples behind you.
I also got to go to the White House and meet the president because I made a quilt that they requested go into the White House craft collection. And, you know, sewing's a lot more than just stitching, and it sort of teaches you the life lessons that you need to know. And one of them was, it does matter what it looks like on the inside. I was one of those kids that I didn't care about the process. I just wanted to have it done, and I wanted it to be done fast, and I wanted it to look great. And one of the lessons I learned from 4-H is if you want it to look good, you have to do every step the right way. And that was a hard life lesson to learn. I also have vivid memories of sitting in front of a sewing machine that if I had been strong enough, I would have picked up and thrown across the room. I learned a lot of respect for mechanical things, and I learned that if you speak nicely to them and treat them well, they will reward you. And if you don't, they will get you. So now I make sure that I have about 10 sewing machines at any given time, so if one misbehaves, I can use another. But the as everyone in this room has confirmed, 4-H was so important to so many of us living in an isolated rural area. It gave us a chance to get together with our friends and also to interact with older people, which is very important. For many people, sometimes the only older folks they know are their own family and their teachers. So this was a chance for us to build relationships with people outside our families, and those are still special to us today, as you can see by what's happening here. So I want to say thank you to all those women who worked with us girls. And I remember Dot, and I remember my Aunt Carol, and I still, to this day, I'm a good cook. And when I measure flour, by God, I do it the way I was taught in 4-H.
I brought some things that you can look at later. It's not so much about 4-H, but it's where 4-H led me. Okay? Don't forget, we've got one more.
Yeah, let's see. One I've got here is Margaret. Margaret Wilson. I started with washing cows. Our oldest son was in 4-H, and he had a cow that he wanted to take that cow to Barton, the fair. And in order to go, he had to scrub his toes all around. So we tied him up to the tree, and we sat there and scrubbed with ties for hours.
I can't follow Judy at all, but I remember Mary Merrill was my leader, and I don't know if I had any leaders, so I don't really remember. I know I've been cooking for about 8 years, and my first cooking demonstration, I had to dice potatoes, and I didn't learn to cook that way. You know, I learned to cook when Mother used her hand to dice. And so anyways, they asked me, why are you using a cutting board? And I said, because I was told I had to. So I got marked off for that. I learned what not to say in front of crowds. And in sewing, which I took for about 5 years, I learned to become very good at taking things out. So I put them back in the right way. And so I just thank you. My children didn't even know I could sew until about 5 years ago. So I guess when they were born, I stopped sewing. But I'm trying to teach them a little bit. I wish somebody had taught them like you taught them. It was very good for speaking. You know, we gave demonstrations. We had to go in front of crowds, and it was a very good thing. Met a lot of people that.
any other remedies? Well, I would like a round of applause for this part of the panel, and then we'll move to the, we'll move to the next generation will show us a new way of presenting this. So a round of applause. I became involved with 4-H because I'm the mother of boys, but I'm very committed to leadership opportunities for girls. And I was never in 4-H as a child. I grew up with Girl Scouts. My mother was a professional Girl Scout leader all over the world. And so my experience was all Girl Scouts. But I wanted an experience where I could be working with my boys, but also have opportunities for girls. And nowadays with 4-H, we just have clubs. We don't have girls' clubs and boys' clubs. And I want you to know that we have a whole generation of boys who will make very good husbands because they're very good at sewing and very good at cooking. 4-H is, so many of the things are just the same. I think that we're still sleeping on the same mattresses at Eastern States, Lewis, that you probably slept on your very first year. And it's still all about the leaders. And Lori Courage is here today in the back row. She's one of those wonderful moms that's always there driving. Julie Brochu is another one of our moms. Stephanie Foster, you know, it takes lots and lots of hands, as you folks all know. It's still about public speaking. These current members don't know, but when they're taking a calf into the show ring, they are learning public speaking because they need to present themselves, they need to answer questions. Yes, they go interview still for trips to Washington, D.C. and for different awards, and those are interview skills that they will use to go to college, that they will use for job interviews, and that they will use to, you know, find dates. So all of those skills still are the same very much. And at this point, I'm going to turn it over for the members themselves to talk to you and show you some of the things that they're working on. Our slide presentation was put together by Logan Courage. Thank you very much, Logan. He was our background on the technical with all sorts of added extra effects from Carl Fontaine. Yes, Carl. Okay, so we're starting off with, who's going first today? Carl, are you starting? So come on up, buddy. Show them you know how to do it.
Craftsbury, Vermont. Our club started in 1999. We do community service. We focus a lot on that. There are four 4-H members still active in the 4-H club. And past projects is sewing. Demonstrations, and a while ago we went camping at Mount Elmore and it started to rain and we were coming down the mountain and we were all running back down.
I asked Carl, the way that we got our name is that Heather Urey, at our very first meeting, we were trying to come up with a name. And she said, well, we want to do everything. So our name's going to be Everything 4-H.
Hello, my name is Chris Fontaine. I've been in 4-H for almost 7 years. This is Old Home Day at Craftsbury Common. We just got done doing a parade. We have some of our dairy up there, poking their heads over the fence. They're a little shy at first. This is regional eggs. This is the Ukrainian eggs we made. We made it to State Day with this action exhibit. We were washing our calves. This is right before the state show and the dairy showing. We were getting up the rough stains and polishing them up before we go in the ring. And this is the rewarding part. Andrew and I. Andrew got grand champion and supreme champion of his class, and I'm in the show ring. To go to Washington, D.C. I didn't get to meet with the president, but I got to meet with our senators of Vermont. And I have a scrapbook over at our exhibit.
I am Andrew Calderwood, and I've been in 4-H since I was 8. And one of our community service projects was our pet show at the Craftsbury Community Care Center for the Elders. This is actually the second one we have done. This is also the pet show. All the elders, they really like the seeing the animals. This is a community service at Laguerre's Farm Stand in July. This is a 4-H group from Pennsylvania. They came up and was staying with us for a week. And we went and we gleaned the fields at Laguerre's Farm Stand. And we took all the strawberries that we gleaned from the fields and took them to the food bank to donate for hungry people. After Hurricane Katrina, the 4-H club made a quilt that we raffled off, and we donated the money to rebuilding. This holiday season, we also had a silent auction and made some cookie mixes and brownie mixes, and we took that money and we donated to the Ronald McDonald House. And one of the things that 4-H has helped me with is it inspired me to also join National Holstein, which is another organization, which is just dairy and cows. And that has taken me to the states, New England, and national levels. And that's been a really good experience for me. Oh, and this is another slide of public community service. This is at the Barton Fair. It's the Youth Dairy Barn. And we are repainting it because it needs it.
Hello, my name is Doug Calderwood. I've been in 4-H for 8-9 years now. This past summer, we hooked up with a 4-H group from Pennsylvania, and they came out here for a week. They had to come up with the funding to get out here, and then once they were out here, we took care of them. We put them up at our houses and went out and gleaned food. We also went up to Montreal, and we also went to Mount Washington. Now this next summer, we will be going out there to see them for a week. And for going out there, we've made wreaths for earning money. Here we are making wreaths. We sold about 40, 50 wreaths, and that was a really good funder. Also, we helped a local neighbor cleaning up her sheep fields. We were pulling thistles for her for a whole day. Also, I have gone to the Coos Moriarty 4-H camp. I've gone there for 3 years in a row, I guess, now. And that's a lot of fun. I've also gone up there. They've extended it off from the 4-H based stuff, and they've actually got a whole week, three, 4 days of just straight rock climbing that I've gone up there for a couple of times.
Hi, my name is Reed Cahoon. This is my third year in 4-H. Some future plans that our club is